The next case, number 23-1872, Jose Ernesto Hernandez Castrodad et al. Versus Sigfrido Stidel Figueroa. At this time, would counsel for the appellants please come to the podium and introduce himself on the record to begin?
Yes, good morning. The main issue here has turned into a jurisdictional issue because of the discharge order issued in the Romesa case. And what plaintiffs want to point out here is that what they are requiring the defendant to do is forward-looking compliance model and to exercise what they believe are the rights on the eminent domain provision that a body has to be paid in full for a condemnation proceeding by the state, and that would include the main amount that is given for the property taken by the government, plus the interest without the legal. The two areas are beyond the discharge order. First area, we're requesting defendant, an order directed to defendant in a matter that is it's going to be repeating itself over and over the years. Remember that this starts with some change in the law done in 1991 and interest on principals that had already paid, had been already paid, stayed with the government for more than 20 years. That's what the record shows, and that's something that cannot be reasonably controverted. This will keep happening, although there is an injunctive order directed to the administrator that the interest amount has to follow the principal. When the principal is paid, you have to compute the interest and pay it.
Could you give us some kind of indication as to how widespread a problem this is?
Excuse me?
How widespread a problem is this? I mean, how much property has been taken and how much money is do you think the Commonwealth is holding in these takings? I mean, in terms of dollar amount, how many people
are impacted? And I want to clarify this for the record because I want to add a fact for the record which I learned yesterday. I already told the police counsel. She's at some point after the effective day of the plan, the defendant did what they should have done from day one. They identified a person who had amounts to their name, contact them, and offer them the amounts. And that was after the effective day. And for example, my client had an interest around there. I don't know exactly what was the number. It was like $2,000, $1,000 something. That amount was there, and there was the issue of the 15% administrative charge. We levied on that, but the principal amount was still there. The principal amount, not the principal amount, when he was paid in the beginning, the principal of the interest that was there. Because let me backtrack a little bit. Perhaps I can. There's a condemnation proceeding. $2 million are put to the name of my client. My client first starts to say that that amount is not correct, such and such, but eventually an agreement is reached, and he files to withdraw the $2 million.
Wait a minute. An agreement is reached, then becomes a judgment?
Yes, in the state court.
In the state court.
In the state court, an agreement is reached.
Wait a minute. Yes. Judge Barrett and I were talking about this morning. Okay, a judgment is reached. Is the money then... But is the amount of the judgment then deposited somewhere?
No, the amount of the money is a condemnation proceeding. The amount is deposited beforehand.
Okay.
Because the state, the Commonwealth, takes possession of the property immediately upon the filing of the case. They file the condemnation proceeding. Here's the check for $2 million. Give me the property. And they acquire the property immediately. The only thing that the person can do is challenge the amount. If he believes the amount is unfair or is lower
than... Yeah, and they challenged it here, right?
Yes.
And then when they came to an agreement as to what the amount would be, is that reduced to a judgment?
Yes.
Yeah, and following that judgment, did that increase the amount?
No. When the amount was deposited, there was a time while that amount was there in which that amount generated interest.
I'm not asking that question. The government's going to take your property,
yes,
and they say $100,000. At that moment, they have to put $100,000 into an account.
Yes.
Okay. Then the other side says it shouldn't be $100, it should be $200.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a fight.
Yes, I understand that the amount was increased.
Plaintiff wins. There's a judge, let's imagine, the plaintiff wins, so now the judgment says, no, it's not 100, it's 150. So another 50,000 has to go in, right? I'm not asking about this case, I just want to understand how it works. When the 50,000 has to go in, what happens? That's then put into the same account?
Yes, it's in the same account.
Okay, and then?
And that's an interest-bearing account.
It's an interest-bearing
account. And the interest?
Is the account commingled with other students, or is it
separate? It's an aggregate account. It's an aggregate account. It's commingled by everybody. Monies are put in their name, go into the same account.
And are you claiming, in this case, how much was originally put into the account before the dispute about the amount?
I think that that amount that was originally put was the final amount also. But I am not really sure about it. But I do believe it that there was some hassle in terms of the amount that was going to be paid. But finally, the amount, the $2 million, were agreed upon. And a judgment entered for the $2 million.
Okay. And the 15% rule, the state law, the Puerto Rico law that says 15% comes out, does that apply?
No, it doesn't apply to the principal.
No, I didn't ask that.
Okay.
Does that apply to the interest earned
on the
on the $2 million that's in there before there's a judgment, and to the amount that's in there after the judgment?
Yes.
Okay. The part that applies after the judgment, that 15% rule, does that apply to all judgments or only eminent domain judgments?
You have left all judgments?
All judgments. But the eminent domain part, the 15%, that applies even, that's especially applies just to the, there's no judgment when the money's put in by the government, right?
Yeah, because this applies also when third parties deposit monies on behalf of others.
Yeah.
Which is a different scenario, and that's what we are arguing. There's a different scenario where a third party puts money in your favor, and the court has to administer that money. And it's fair for the court to say that these monies are not mine, these monies are here, I am administering them because voluntarily the parties have
What are the bounds of what you think is where the 15% causes a problem?
The 50% causes a problem and in two accounts, two different ways. First problem is that when the principal is disbursed, because the judgment comes for the principal.
It's
$2 million.
Is that dispersed after that?
Yes, it is for that, and it must disperse.
Okay, but that the clock for that, unless I'm misunderstanding something, you just use the word judgment.
Yes.
There's no judgment when the government first puts the $2 million into the account.
There's no judgment.
So you're only objecting from the moment when the judgment hits.
That's right.
Is that right?
Yes. When the judgment comes in, there's an amount that has been generated in interest because the $2 million were sitting there for a while, and there's an amount in interest for that $2 million that were in an interest-bearing account. The judgment comes and says, Commonwealth, you have to pay the $2 million for the property. They cut a check. The Hacienda, the Treasury, cuts a check from this aggregate account for $2 million.
Do they cut it for $2 million plus the accrued interest on $2 million?
That's the problem.
Okay, so they just cut it.
That's a problem.
That has nothing to do with 15% then.
No, at that juncture, no.
And you're objecting to that?
Yes, because they had to pay the interest at the time they deliver the principal. Interest follows principal. How can you
okay.
Pay the interest?
Okay. Okay. So interest on that up until the time of the disbursement of the funds, that you're looking for that.
Yes.
And the 15%, you're saying that's calculated based upon only the post-judgment interest.
No, for the interest, it is calculated from the first moment.
Okay, so pre and post.
Yeah, pre and post.
But I don't understand. They're not paying you any interest.
They're not paying any interest.
So what is, but they're taking 15. Are they calculating and then taking 15%?
Because you know, the problem is, and they devised an internal regulation was not developed to the public, that because these funds were in an aggregate account, you had to file a form, a separate form, telling them, calculate my interest and give me my money. And if you didn't do that, you didn't get your interest. And that's the problem in this case. Nobody practically did that in 20 years.
That's clearly a problem, and that's a separate problem. We're still just trying to figure out, they calculate the 15% on the prejudgment and the post-judgment interest.
Interest, yeah. Not the principal, the interest.
Just on the interest.
Yes, but if that's right, then what you're saying is, even though they, just so I understand, they pay you $2 million, no interest,
yes,
minus 15% of the interest that they didn't pay you?
No, because the problem
was... You're saying no, I don't understand.
Yes.
You should be saying yes, I thought.
No, because the interest was never paid until after this case was filed.
So that means the only 15% deduction is occurring once there is interest that's being earned at all, which is post-judgment.
Yeah. Yes, it's post-judgment, and in this case, it's post 2022, which is post implementation of the plan also. The money, so
that's
actually
paid. I don't think that's what you're saying. I don't think that's what you're saying. Unless I'm misunderstanding what you're saying. You have a condemnation. Let's assume that they throw in $2 million into a bank account. Everybody, forget about the proceedings. Everybody's agreed about the $2 million. So, for 10 years, $2 million is sitting there collecting some kind of interest.
No, the $2 million were paid.
For 10 years, $2 million is no. That okay?
Let me clarify that. At the time of the judgment, the principal was paid. The $2 million were paid. No issue with that. We know the deduction. But the interest on the $2 million for the time it was sitting there while the case was employed were not paid.
Okay.
And 20-something years later, mm-hmm. 2024, after this case was filed, and after the plan came into action in 2022, surprisingly, and it's not surprising, it's because of this case. Defendants did what they have to do from the outside. They identify the persons that have the money in their account.
During the pendency of the dispute over the amount, the money is collecting interest.
Yes.
Okay, so it takes 10 years to resolve. It's like that.
No,
ten.
We weren't there.
I was hypothetically. If it takes 10 years to resolve the dispute, you're saying you got 10 years worth of interest that's been accruing.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you've got the pre-judgment accruing interest. And then you're saying that post-judgment, further interest is being accrued on what?
Because the
on what?
On the interest. On the
so
interest,
interest on interest.
By the 10 years. In which the $2 million were sitting there.
Okay, interest on interest is the quote. That's interest on principal.
Yeah. Because the problem here is because the interest was not dispersed with the principal. There remains the interest only in an account. And that's what stayed there for 20-something years. The interest. Because the problem here is that under the general principle that
okay,
you
so
cannot give the interest.
Is there a dispute as to whether the Commonwealth will pay you the accrued interest?
Well, they paid my client the accrued interest 24 years after.
After this case. Okay, but they paid it.
They created, after the fact, a procedure in 2024, if I remember, 2025, and they sent letters to persons they could identify, because there are persons they can't identify after 20-something years. They have this money.
They paid your client the accrued interest.
Minus the 25%, yes.
25 or 15?
Yeah, excuse me, 15%. Okay. I stand correct. 50%.
Okay, so is the only thing we're fussing about here today the 15% administrative fee?
No, Your Honor, there are two things that were questioned. Three things.
Yes.
First of all, there is an equitable relief asked from the defendant, which is that this type of situation has to stop prospectively, because if not, it's going to keep repeating itself. There has to be a procedure for him to, as soon as the principal is paid, you have to pay the interest.
How can it keep happening to him?
It's certainly not going to happen again.
You're absolutely right.
So then he doesn't get it. He doesn't get to seek it for other people.
You know, I think this is a, you can factor the
it's not a class, is there a certified class?
There's not a certified class.
So you can assert that
even though my client was paid after this case.
What injury is going to harm him in the future? Anything?
No.
Okay.
It would have to be under the exception of susceptible to repetition.
Well, is he going to have more property taken?
No. Well, he himself, no.
But yeah, but that's how he's capable of repetition of you, not of anybody on earth. Otherwise, it's a de facto class. Okay, so let's say we don't agree with you on that. What's the second thing you want?
Okay, the second thing is the eminent domain nature of these proceedings, which the Title III court said that you, if you have an eminent domain, you have a right for just compensation, whatever that is. And my contention, our contention on that, is that the just compensation is the principal amount deposited plus the interest generated without any deduction.
So he wants payment of that amount.
Of the 50%
And he hasn't gotten that.
He hasn't gotten that.
He asked for that.
Yes, that's good. And
he himself personally, not on behalf of other people. He's asked for his 15%, and the Commonwealth has said no.
Yes.
Okay.
When did that, where is that in the record?
In every filing. The position that the monies have to pay, being paid without the 15%.
No, I understand there's a statute that says that. Where is in the record, is there an indication of your client requesting it and being denied?
From whom?
From the Commonwealth.
Well, the critical reason, and that's a wrong decision from our perspective, that because the plaintiff didn't go to the state court judge saying, hey, listen, you have to order the Treasury Department to give me the interest on our principal. He lacks standing to pursue this case. And the case closed that door interlocutorily and remain on where the 15% levied was a fair amount of money. But the first part of the case, which is also an appeal here, entails a wrong decision by the court, because it says that the plaintiff doesn't have standing because he didn't request the interest from the Puerto Rico court, which is not true.
The interest or the administrative fee?
No, the interest.
You got the interest now.
Yes,
26. Minus the 15%.
Yeah.
So, once again, is there any place in the record you can point to where your client has asked for the return of what they're labeling administrative fee?
Yes, there's been prompt relief requested that even remain independent
of the suit. Is there any indication prior to filing the suit that you asked for the Commonwealth to pay that 15%?
No. And in that sense, the lower decision, although we disagree with the weight given to that fact by the lower court, the fact is real. I was not attorney. The attorney asked for the principle. He didn't ask for the interest. And that's what the court uses as a standing issue, or it's not. The principle is there. And you don't need a separate order for the interest to be paid. When the principle is paid, you have to pay the interest also, which is the gist of plaintiff's claim in this case.
It's clear that somebody agrees as far as your client is concerned on that point because they paid the interest. Your client has been paid the principal and the interest as he's owed.
But not the full interest.
But not the full interest.
And so we're
trying to narrow the issues that are before the court. The only issue seemingly before the court now is your client entitled to get paid the 15% that was deducted for, as an administrative fee. Is that correct?
And you're saying,
there's fees also.
Okay. And there's an argument that there was never a request for that administrative fee, and that stands away. And you say that's basically ridiculous because the statute says they can't give it. So what's the talk?
Principal. If you pay the principal, you have to pay the interest. There need to be no order, no form, anything on that. You have to pay the interest. You cannot keep the interest for 20 years because of whatever internal reason you may have a problem. Because the main reason is the problem they have with the aggregate account, which they have to calculate independently for each person.
But isn't there a simple statute that authorizes them, at least in certain instances, to apply an administrative fee or stance that administrative fee?
Yes, but our argument on that is twofold, and it's detailed on the brief. First of all, that doesn't allow you to keep the interest after the principal is paid. The statute doesn't allow that. So whatever was charged after the judgment, after the principal amount was paid, could not be charged. And second, because of the nature of the eminent domain proceeding, and this is the way that the account has monies that are not eminent domain. But on eminent domain proceedings, when the government puts the money to pay for your property, the just compensation that you are entitled to is the money that was deposited, the interest that money generated, and no deductions can be done of that, because that's a different scenario. When you take into account that third parties deposit money in favor of another.
Well, I mean, the bottom line is any so-called administrative fee was not a process that benefited your client.
That's exactly the point.
You're saying it's not a problem that you didn't ask for.
I'm absolutely positive that it should not be a problem. That is not a problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would the first counsel for the appellee please introduce himself on the record to begin?
Good morning. My name is Juan Marquez. I represent the appellee. Judge, some of the people stated here, while in his official capacity as administrator of the Office of Courts Administration.
Do you have a problem returning the administrative fee?
We have a problem. We are authorized by law to keep the administrative fee, and we're not planning on returning that money.
An eminent domain proceeding is different from, say, parties suing one another, depositing money in the court's registry, and the court holding it for their benefit. There's no benefit that endures to someone whose property has been taken for you to hold their money in an escrow account.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because the only way you can get the just compensation after an eminent domain proceeding is to participate in the eminent domain proceeding before the Commonwealth Courts. So, even though the defendant in that case is providing involuntarily, the only way he can get his money is by participating. And the administrative fee is imposed because of a service that the government provides, which is to keep and manage those funds.
They're not your fund.
That's the whole point of the
compensation requirement.
Yes, but while the case has been litigated, and sometimes it takes years, the court has to have an infrastructure to keep those funds in a place Yes, because
the for whose benefit?
And who pays for it? That's the question. Is that
we're
questioning that there shouldn't be a process. The question is who should pay for it?
Whether you have that infrastructure or not, at the end of the day, under the just compensation clause, you must pay just compensation.
Correct.
And that includes interest.
Then whether you have a bad process or a good process, that person's entitled to just compensation.
Correct.
So you decided it would be easier for you to make sure you make that payment to have this process, right?
Yes.
Why should they pay for that?
Because they're using the system.
They're not using the system. They're using the Constitution, which requires them to get just compensation. You've chosen to do it this way. You can do it however you want. At the end of the day, they have to get just compensation. If it costs you a lot to figure out how to get them that, why do they have to pay for that?
Because there's a law that says...
Yeah, well, that's the question that they're challenging. They're challenging the legality of that law.
And the law has no exception to say, except you get paid in case...
And that's all. That's why you may be having a problem. Because they contend that's illegal.
Under the Constitution.
Under the Constitution.
I don't see what clause in the Constitution is.
Because it's their property and their money that they're being paid for you to take their property.
Well, first of all, the judiciary is not taking the property. It's the state.
But you're
part of the state.
We're just having the process, and the process requires that I have an account, and I have to manage that account.
That's great, and it's just, that's what you're doing, what Puerto Rico law says. It's just if the Constitution says Puerto Rico can't do it that way, tough luck.
I mean, on behalf of the judiciary, you can tell the executive branch of the government you need money to... process these compensation claims, but it doesn't mean that they have to put the financial burden that results in them getting their property taken from them.
Well, this very decision that doesn't make that distinction. This very decision looks at whether or not a service is being provided to the citizens and allows a reasonable fee to be collected for the services provided. And in this case, the service that courts provides to the defendants in an eminent domain proceeding
is spare an eminent domain case.
They say
spare an eminent domain case.
No, it's not.
Yeah. But that's the whole point that everyone keeps making, is this is different, as it's eminent domain. Because you took something that you have to pay, give back to them. So there's no service to them.
Well, I respectfully
they don't have to pay you
to take their money.
They're not paying me for taking the money. They're paying me for safeguarding that money while the process is being...
Safeguarding whose money?
The money that was deposited by the government.
And whose money is that?
That money belongs to the person who...
Yeah. Well, that's very nice of you to safeguard it for them. But if they'd like you not to do that, shouldn't they have a say about that? If they could safeguard it for cheaper?
Well, that's the only way they can get the money is through the eminent
domain. Under the statute.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you've set it up that way. You don't have to set it up that way. And you set it up in a way in which they get less at the end. So they say that's illegal.
In any event, I wanted to say a couple of things. First of all, they have never asked for that money.
And by that money, you mean what? The interest?
The interest, they never asked for it, and they never asked for
the administrative
fee to go back.
But how did they get the interest paid? That they got the interest paid, so did they not ask for it, and somebody just rolled up and gave it to them?
At the end of the proceeding, there's a motion that is filed, and it's required by Rule 68 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, in eminent domain proceedings specifically, you have to file a motion, and you have to request the disbursement of the funds.
And they did that?
Yeah. They represented to the court that they did that. I checked very recently, and that was not what I saw.
How did they get paid interest? You're saying they never asked for it.
How do they get the interest?
They came to court and today. They conceded they got paid the interest that was owed to them, minus the 15%. How did they get paid the interest if they didn't ask for it? Is that an automatic computation at the end of the judgment process?
No. What counsel explained is that from 2022 on, the courts were able to develop a platform electronically that would streamline the process. And he explained that this client got a notice that there was interest deposited in the accounts, and he had to file several documents in order to get it. That's how you get it nowadays.
So he asked for
it. That's what he represented to the court. When I checked, that hasn't happened yet.
But you acknowledge he got paid the interest.
I cannot confirm that.
Oh, okay.
Why would you come to court without being able to confirm that he got paid the interest?
Because I did check when counsel told me yesterday that they had got the interest. The information that I had from 2 weeks ago was that the money was still in the accounts of the courts. And I checked this morning, and that was confirmed to me that the money has not been requested yet. But he's making the representation here that he did get the money.
Did you check to see if the money, assuming he didn't request it, has been paid?
Yes, I checked that. And to my knowledge, that money is still in the account. It's about $1,900. This just happened today, yesterday, so, you know.
I didn't expect that the way this would play out is that the plaintiff would say he got the money and the defendant would say he didn't.
Yeah, I didn't expect that either.
So based upon the checking you did, what is the amount of administrative fee based upon the 15% interest that was deducted from whatever amount of interest he got paid that you don't know about?
The amount.
What is the amount that you think he's asking you to give him?
That would be 15% of the interest.
Which is what dollar amount?
The dollar amount that I checked recently was about $1,900.
So he's wanting you to give him 15% of the $1,900.
Right. But the things that they never asked.
So a couple hundred bucks, maybe.
Yes, they never asked the local court to do that. They went straight to federal court and asked this court to order that.
Is that beyond it? People can't pick up the phone and say you're looking for a couple hundred dollars in order to avoid oral argument today and get rid of this lawsuit. We'll give you $200.
Well, I was informed by the counsel that he had been paid. I called my client, see, can you check it? And my client told me that that amount is still in the account. That there might be some, timing issues here because apparently this happened very recently. I can go and verify again, but as far as I know, the amount hasn't been filed.
Can I understand one thing about this 15%? So that $1,900 is a part of function of all the pre-judgment interest that the money was accruing that was going to be the amount you were going to pay for the property.
Correct.
Right? Then post-judgment, there was some other amount that's accruing in consequence of it being in the account after judgment, right?
The interest. Yeah, the interest. Yeah. Yes.
The 15%, does it only apply to the post-judgment interest?
That is correct.
So when you said there's 1900, it'd be 15% of what amount?
Of 1900.
It's 15% of 19. But why would it be? I'm just trying to figure out if it only applies to the post-judgment interest. That's because it's the interest you're not disputing anymore. That they're entitled to interest on the $2 million during that period pre-judgment.
We always consider that that money belongs to
the. Okay, so that they get the interest on that, and
yes.
Then it's just the interest on that interest, but only for the period of time once judgment entered.
From the moment
judgment.
Yes.
So when did the judgment enter?
In this particular case, yeah. I know the case was filed in 2011, so I don't understand why it's for about 25 years, but sometime after that, 18 years.
I see, so it'd be about 15 years of interest on $1,900?
15 years because 2011 was the date that the any underlying proceeding was filed.
Oh, what, when was the judgment that led to the post-judgment period?
I don't have that.
But roughly speaking, like 10 years ago?
It would take 4, 5, 6, 10 years.
Okay, so but we've got maybe it's 5 or 6 years of interest on $1,900.
Let's say that, yes.
And then you say you would deduct 15% of that amount.
See, only when I cut the check of the interest do I take the 15%. If the interest had not been paid, we haven't realized the 15% administrative fee. That is realized when the check for the interest is cut.
And so you're saying until they ask for the interest, you wouldn't even do this calculation. There's no deduction, and that's why you think they don't have standing because they didn't ask for the interest. Is that the idea?
They never asked for the interest. They never asked for the administrative fee. And therefore, that's what the court below ruled that.
But then the district court reversed itself as the 15% fee, right?
Just on the issue of giving the plaintiff the ability to question the reasonableness under the Sperry doctrine.
And then on the merits, she says they just haven't done that, so they're out.
Correct. So the dismissal regarding the interest is without prejudice, so they could go to the local court and ask for it, and it would be given to them.
And then last question, just on the reasonableness. I know the district court said they didn't do anything to question the reasonableness under Sperry, but maybe this just takes us back to where we started with you. What is, in this context, conceivably reasonable about charging a service fee to deduct from the interest that you owe them as just compensation? Even if in other cases there's a reason for you to want to deduct it, when we're talking about money you owe them for taking their property, how can it ever be reasonable for you to take a cut of that for the cost of you ensuring you can pay them when you're owed?
Remember, the judiciary is not taking the property.
But we're determined, I understand. You, no one's saying you're a bad person.
We're treating
you as Puerto Rico for purposes of this appeal.
Right.
Because that's who's doing it. The government has set up a system whereby they take property, as they're entitled to do, pay just compensation, and our question is, what is reasonable about saying that rather than give you everything you're owed, we're going to give you everything you're owed minus what it took us to make sure we paid you what we had to pay you?
Because in order to complete the process, I had to spend the cost.
Yes. You don't really have anything that makes it reasonable, what it sounds like.
Well, on the record, there's a cost analysis that was prepared by a certified public accountant. It's like 60 pages long, makes a huge analysis and determines that a reasonable amount is 15%.
But there's nothing that explains why it's reasonable to charge that in the context of eminent domain. Other than what you keep saying, which is that's how Puerto Rico chose to make sure we could pay you what we owe you.
The law has no such effect.
Okay, thank you. Anything else?
My colleague was going to argue the issue regarding the PROMESA, the jurisdictional issues on that. So
that would be helpful.
Please introduce yourself on the record to begin.
Good morning. For the record, Attorney Andrew Tremonti from Paul Desk, on behalf of Appleby. As my colleague Juan Magnesios mentioned, I'm here to discuss the jurisdictional questions that were raised by this court's October 3, 2024 order. So, as we've been referring, we divided appellant's claims into two categories. So, we have the interest claim and we have the administrative fee. Now, in light of the representations that counsel just mentioned regarding whether the interest was paid or not, it's questionable whether the interest claim issue is now moot at this point. I don't know if the board wants me to go through that analysis organizational questions. So if we skip that for the time being, let's focus in on the administrative fee. So on the administrative fee, there's one of the first questions was whether that violated the automatic stay. Now, our position with regards to that is that, yes, it would violate the automatic stay. Now, my client already mentioned that there's a specific law in which the Commonwealth has an interest with regards to that 15% fee because we sold that law.
Could you pin down
yes.
very specifically what you're saying violated the stay?
So to the extent that the appellants, when they filed this complaint in 2020, this was before the title of the Commonwealth's Title III plan was confirmed, and definitely before the effective date on March 15, 2022.
So you're saying the filing of the lawsuit violated the automatic stay?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay.
Because the appellant was requesting at the end of the day this payment of money. They wanted to collect with regards to the administrative fee and wanted to be returned to them.
And isn't there a carve out for eminent domain cases?
There is a carve out for eminent domain cases, but in our view, there's a distinction between the interest claims, which we detail in our brief, vis-a-vis the administrative fee. As we lay out, the distinction is we see the interest fee as being part and parcel of the eminent domain slash inverse condemnation claim as defined at
area B. But why is the administrative fee not also? I understand that the administrative fee doesn't have to be tied to eminent domain. But from the perspective of a person seeking just compensation,
so
what they're saying is, I'm not getting just compensation because I'm not getting the 15%.
That is a very interesting question that you're posing. And what we can rely on is, remember, because we're talking about the municipal bankruptcy, essentially on steroids, which is PROMESA, at the end of the day in Title III, so we have to go to the code and to how the plan defines the claim. And it is very broad. Right, and specifically, it has a specifically carve out on what is an eminent domain claim in the context of Title III.
What's it say?
And with regards to the eminent domain, bear with me if I have it. This here we go. Eminent domain inverse condemnation claim. This is defined at Section 1.212 of the plan. It's a claim arising from or related to an eminent domain proceeding. An eminent domain proceeding is the Commonwealth Court, which is defined at 1.213. And a final order entered therein, including, without limitation, interest accrued with respect thereto. Now, two things which are interesting here. The first one is there's a requirement. In order to determine what the amount of the claim is a final order. Now, as opposing counsel just discussed, at the time in the Commonwealth proceeding, and as my colleague also clarified, there was no request with regards to the administrative fee, which was embedded in the judgment at that time. Just as there was no request with regards to the interest.
So just let me just playing this out. If there had been a request, and let's say they got a answer back, no, we're not going to pay you the administrative fee, pursuant to blah, 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 that says we can keep the 15%. If they had filed suit at that point, you might say the stay does not block the suit?
If they had requested at that point, in that specific proceeding,
and gotten a denial,
and gotten a denial,
and then filed suit, same claim they make now, which is, look, we saw it, it was challenging the order denying us this, you'd say the stay does not apply.
Well, that is another interesting reason for another. And now we have to go to Section 58.1 of the plan. I would agree if, as part of the eminent domain proceeding itself, which, again, is a state court proceeding where the money was deposited, the compensation occurred. Let's play out that scenario. Let's assume they request, on or close to the final order, I want the admin fee or the interest, whichever. And it is denied. Two things would happen. They could seek request for reconsideration as part of that same proceeding, right? So all of it is encompassed in the eminent domain proceeding. If we go to Section 58.1 of the plan, the carve out to the automatic stay is if there's a dispute in that proceeding. The problem we have is that that did not occur at that proceeding. A separate suit was filed in September 2020, before the United States District Court, asserting all of those issues. Now, here's where we have the disconnect between what the plan and the confirmation order provides a carve-out to the eminent domain claims, and the appropriate forums discuss that. So playing that scenario, Judge, if we wanted to figure out that the eminent fee was not included, it should have been pursued there. There would have been a final order there, and all of that would have been kosher with regards to the automatic stay.
If I boil it down to essentials, you're just saying to take advantage of that exception, at a minimum, they have to show a final order that they're challenging. And on this record, your basic point is there just is no final order that they've identified, so they can't take advantage of the carve-out, so the stay applies.
That is correct. And because if the stay applies, which is our view, then all of those actions in the district court, including the appeal, would be null and void, meaning that there would be no jurisdiction.
Can we go back to the Commonwealth Court where the eminent domain procedure plays out? When the judgment is entered over there, does it say judgment in the amount of X amount of principal plus interest minus the administrative fee? In other words, how is the plaintiff given notice that an administrative fee prior to actual distribution is going to be deducted from their money?
I do not have an answer to that question. I believe that would have been the issues that were discussed. My colleague, Bob, I guess, would have discussed. I don't know.
You're arguing,
yes,
that they should have played all of this out in the Commonwealth Court.
That's correct.
So I'm trying to figure out how would they have done that.
So once they have the final order, and this was...
What does the final order say?
In this specific case, the issue became with regards to the amount that was originally deposited by the government agency that initiated the condemnation. Ultimately, based on what a co-counsel...
What did the order in the Commonwealth Court say?
I do not know the answer to that, Judge. I would not like to mislead you, because that was not within the purview of my issues on the list.
Except you're arguing it.
I don't understand, Your Honor. I'm arguing with regards to the jurisdictional questions. You do pose a very good question. I unfortunately do not have that fact ready with me.
But they're not, I'm sorry, Counselor, this one, they're not, as you understand it, they're not contending that the final order they're challenging is that final order.
I absolutely agree with you.
So basic question maybe, if I'm following your train of logic, whatever objections they want to make to applying the stay in the circumstances, blah, 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 they can make all those, but they haven't. But the basic thing is, if they're contending the stay does not apply because of the carve-out, that's just not true, in your view, because the carve-out only applies when there's an order, and they simply haven't identified an order that gives them the benefit of the carve-out.
That is absolutely what I'm arguing. That's where the rubber meets the road here. Because of how the plan is stated, particularly as to the exception of the automatic stay, all of those questions that you're raising, Judge Thomas, would have been pursued in the state court. That is not what appellants did. Plaintiffs chose to file a separate proceeding seeking what they deem as equitable relief, but ultimately it is a barbarity claim.
Thank you.
We respond to plaintiffs.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in this case.